the title you've got in the materials is a bit misleading. I originally thought that I would give a talk on forensic linguistics and what it's all about, and to introduce the session a bit and to talk about some of the questions about the admissibility of linguistic expertise, at least in American courts, and so forth. There's a handout here in front if you'd like.
Thank you.
And then I decided not to do that because I couldn't think of anything new to say, to be honest, because Larry and I have written several articles on this, and we've written a book that has several chapters on the issue, and, you know, I think everything I have that I could possibly think about saying on this issue, I have already said. And in addition, Larry is really more of an expert in this area than I am, and so I thought, since we've got Larry to discuss it, why should I be talking about the admissibility issue? So I thought, this being a conference on language and law, and there aren't many conferences that are devoted specifically to language and law, that I would sort of take the opportunity, and I apologize to members of the panel, because I'm not going to talk about linguistic expertise very much. I'd like to talk a little bit about what this enterprise of language and law is all about. Now, language and law have been obviously been related, I think you could say, ever since there has been law. Language and law have to some extent been related. It depends, of course, on how you define law. But it seems to me that it's just about impossible to conceive of law without language because, of course, you need the ability to make and describe legal norms. And the way that we do that, of course, is by language. You can certainly conceive of language without law, right? That's certainly possible. But I think, you know, the opposite is almost impossible. So language is essential because we use it as a means to articulate legal norms. And in addition, it's very important to the legal system because it is the main tool of the legal profession. Lawyers are eminent and often very good users of language. And in fact, the connection between these two, the realization has been around, I think, for quite a while. I've been looking recently at the nature of legal texts and how long, going back in history and trying to find out when people first start to write legal texts and so forth. And you find that almost from the very beginning, when people began to write law, they began to realize that this had certain implications for law and for legal systems. So, for example, there's an interesting inscription which dates from China about 500 years B.C. It seems that a Chinese prime minister ordered that certain laws be written down on bronze tripod vessels. Now, we don't have these bronze tripod vessels anymore. They've disappeared. But we do have a letter, or so I've been told from the secondary literature, there is a letter from a government official around that same time who complained about writing down the law. His objection was that if you wrote them down, people would stop following accepted norms of behavior and would instead make their appeal to the written word, arguing to the last over the tip of an awl or a knife. Now, very prescient observation, it seems to me. Right? The ancient Greeks, of course, also wrote down laws quite a bit, and they thought about this as well. Plato, in a speech by Clinias at one point, wrote that he had actually a more positive view of written law, saying that the greatest help to rational legislation is that the laws, once written down, are always at rest. They can be put to the test at any future time, and therefore, if on first hearing they seem difficult, there is no reason for apprehension about them, because any man, however dull, can go over them and consider them again and again. And of course, that's one of the great benefits of writing down the law. Well, anyway, even though there's this long history, and even though language and law seem to be so intimately related, the basic proposition I'd like to make to you is that, nonetheless, the field of language and law is a relatively marginal one. And in order to try to get a bit of a grasp on that, and here I'm afraid with Jeff Nunberg, the Googling expert in the crowd, makes me a little nervous, but nonetheless, I did some Googling to get some idea of the representation of these various fields. And the results are in your handout, where you sort of get an idea of the relative, I mean, this gives you just a very rough indication, obviously, about how widely known the field of language and law is. But, for example, if you look at language and law, number one, the collocation in quotation marks, I ended up with 61,000, actually 500 hits. Now, that seems like a respectable number. Actually, as just as a matter of interest, the number three hit. These are ranked, I think, in order of how commonly they're accessed, right? It's sort of a rough popularity index. Number three was this conference. So this conference apparently already has started to make an influence or has some impact on that. I'm actually rather, this is an immodest statement, but I'm proud to report that the number one hit was my website, languageandlaw.org. But anyway. And then I thought, well, sometimes we also say language and the law, and that got me another 58,000 hits. And then I tried law and language, and we got out of 126,000, roughly about a quarter of a million hits. Now, that might seem relatively, there's a handout here in front, if you'd like one. That might seem like, you know, they're pretty good numbers until you compare one of the big sort of fields, one of the big interdisciplinary fields these days in the United States, which is law and economics. And when you do that, you'll see the results in number two, you get over 5 million hits. So that puts things into perspective, right? That's roughly a 20-to-1 ratio. And it seems to me that language is certainly as important to law as economics is, and arguably it is more important to law. But nonetheless, you've got this dramatic disparity in these Google hits, which, as I've said, are rough, but nonetheless give you some indication of the difference between the two. Well, I was desperate to make our field a little more relevant, and so I thought, why don't I try law and literature? You can make the argument that we had discussions on law and literature here, and I think actually it's probably a sister discipline to language and law rather than part of language and law, but you can certainly make the argument that it's closely related. And being desperate for more hits, I checked that out, and law and literature, or literature and law, ended up with roughly another quarter of a million. So that gave us, and now we're up to about 500,000 hits overall. Still nowhere near the number for law and economics. Then I thought, well, what about linguistics and law? Because, you know, I was originally a linguist by training before I got into law. That got me a pathetic 1,000 hits. So apparently that term is not being used very much at all. And somewhat, quite a bit more popular is forensic linguistics. This is a panel, of course, on what we might call forensic linguistics. And forensic linguistics has been, the term is being used quite a bit in England, at least. And there are now several universities that have classes, sometimes fairly large programs, in what they call forensic linguistics. And this apparently has driven this number up quite a bit. So, whereas in the United States, people scarcely know what forensic linguistics is. But in England and Australia, to some extent, there's quite a bit of awareness. And you can see that by the fact that we got 70,000 hits. Now, I thought this, actually being Dutch originally, I thought I had to have a quick look at you know, just to get a little comparative look here. And the Dutch numbers are pretty pathetic when it comes to language and law. For example, Recht en Economie, which is law and economics, showed up 150,000 hits, while Recht en Taal, which means language and law, or Taal en Recht, got 235 hits. Huge disparity. Well, we've had a couple of Dutch people here, so we expect you to work on that one. Now, being in Germany, of course, I thought I should also try to see what we end up with German numbers. And so I did some searching there, too. I hope I got the right one, but I tried Sprache und Recht, Recht und Sprache, and those two combinations ended up with somewhat over 20,000 hits, which seems pretty good. And then I also tried Forensische Linguistik. Apparently that term, despite Hannes, that's probably all Hannes Knitschke, but at any rate, he's responsible for 695 hits, and I'm sorry, you're going to have to keep that for the comment period.
1400 for the same
Googling
last Monday.
Oh, what have you done in the meantime? Well, anyway, you know, you can pay Google to increase your results, but anyway. Okay. Obviously, these numbers are subject to a lot of uncertainties, and Jeff, if he wants to, can talk about that. But here's, if you do a comparison, at least on the date that I was doing this, I also tried Recht en Economie, which, you know, law and economics, and I ended up with 16,000. Economie en Recht, another 16,000. And a friend of mine at the University of Frankfurt told me that actually the best phrase for law and economics, as we understand it in the U.S., is Ökonomische Analyse des Rechts. And that phrase came up with 25,000 hits. Now, even if you combine all of those, you see that here now, in Germany at least, we seem to have a relatively respectable showing for language and law. Now, it may be that part of the reason for that, I would guess, is that with the the European Union and so forth, there's been an awful lot of interest in the interaction between language and law, as we've also seen at this conference. So there's some good news, at least in Germany, but I think there's also certainly some challenges out there. You can interpret this one of two ways, it seems to me. One is that language and law is indeed a relatively marginal and useless field, but I assume that if you're here in this room, you're more likely to subscribe to the second possibility, which is that language and law is, in fact, a very useful field, but is underappreciated, right? And so that leads to the question of why is it that this field, at least in my view, tends to be somewhat underappreciated. And that's what I'd like to spend the rest of my time, my 8 minutes and 50 seconds, talking about. Very briefly, and you can read the full paper if you'd like more details, I think there are two main reasons. One is the failure of this field to engage the legal profession. There just has not, the legal profession is quite large, and for the most part, the vast majority of them have no idea that there is such a field as language and law. They've never heard of forensic linguistics, and they might be interested, but so far no one has explained to them how it might be useful for them to inquire a bit further. Now, I don't want to say that there's absolutely no interest, but it is quite limited. And once again, I did a little Googling, and if you Google the term law and economics seminar, you'll find that there are dozens of seminars on this topic being offered at American law schools. If you Google law and literature seminar, you'll find a respectable number of seminars. But if you Google law and language seminar, the first and about only result that you'll get is Lawrence Solon's course at Brooklyn Law School for the law and language seminar. And if you Google language and law seminar, the first and about only course you'll get is, well, you guessed it, Peter Tiersma's course at Loyola Law School. So I think I showed you there's not a lot out there, right? Now, actually, since we have people here from UCLA Law School, David Mellencamp at one point had a course at UCLA, and he was an extremely respected person in the field, but he died a few years ago, and his course has not, as far as I know, is no longer being offered, hasn't been replaced, and Mellencamp himself is probably irreplaceable, but that's another story. So that's sort of the problem, I guess. Now, as I said, there is a bit of interest in various ways in the legal profession. I don't want to point too dire a picture. You'll find there's quite a bit of interest in legal language, language and law, for example, in legal writing courses. So if you ask the average person, is anything done about language at law schools, they'll point to legal writing courses. But these tend to be mainly skills-oriented courses. They tend to be taught very often sometimes by practicing lawyers, sometimes by skilled faculty, who are generally considered to be second-class citizens and who really have very little to say. And in addition, maybe they should be second-class, if anyone here, I apologize, but maybe they should be because as a group, they don't know much about language. They don't have much expertise in linguistics and so forth. You do have that, and you do also... you have a lot of interest in legal dictionaries and style. The lawyers tend to be very interested in that. And Brian Garner, who some of you may know, has become somewhat of a phenomenon and very wealthy also, with his new black dictionary and his style dictionaries and usage guides, which actually are all excellent, and I recommend them. But at any rate, you have that. You do have, of course, the plain English movement, but I don't think there are a lot of legal academics, but there are some interested in that. There are some who are interested in the movement to make jury instructions more understandable, and I personally have spent a lot of time on California's committees. We've drafted new civil and criminal jury instructions. You have some interest in some of the linguistic issues that arise in the substantive law. In criminal law, for example, if you're interested in criminal procedures, terrific article by someone named Janet Ainsworth, who is a legal scholar but also took some classes in linguistics, and wrote a really interesting article about why some of the linguistic strategies that are used by prosecutors to discourage suspects being interrogated from requesting counsel. And she used very good analysis using pragmatics. And there are a number of other articles like of that kind. There's been some discussion about language in constitutional law and the question of what is speech with respect to the free speech clause, right? The distinction between speech and conduct. And some people have used speech act theory. Kent Greenewald is a good example of someone who's tried to look at how speech act theory can help us determine that certain types of speech, like threats, possibly hate speech and so forth, might be classified as conduct rather than speech under the free speech clause. And of course, one area where you'd expect to see a fair amount of activity also would be statutory interpretation. Most people who talk about statutory interpretation don't know much about linguistic theory, but of course, one person who does is right here. Larry Sullivan has written a lot using linguistics, linguistic methods, and so forth, and also cognitive science in order to help understand statutory interpretation. And so that, I think, has made a fair amount of headway. But besides, you know, these sorts of examples, I mean, I could cite a few more. You can look at my paper. You'll see some more examples. Overall, the legal academy and the legal field seem to have very limited appreciation of language and law. Now, the second major issue is that it's a very, to the extent that there are people doing language and law, they tend to be people who are not experts in the legal field. They tend to be linguists and sociologists and anthropologists and so forth. Who often don't have a lot of legal training, and in addition, who tend to come at the issue from a number of very splintered, they all have their own, it's a very fractured field, they all have their own approach. And I tried to list at least the most important ones on your handout, where you see that, this is number 9, you know, law and literature, law and semiotics, law and rhetoric, discourse analysis in the law, multilingualism in the law, philosophy of language in the law, forensic linguistics. You've got like 8 or 9 different sort of little fields that all deal with language and law in some way, but almost never talk to each other. You know, they all do their own thing. And they very seldom have conferences together, and that's why I'm so happy to see this happening here, because we do have some of that going on now. But they all have their own little groups, they have their own little organizations, they have their own little magazines, and they have their own president. I'm the president of the International Association of Forensic Linguists, you know, and for at least another year. They all have their own little groups, and they just don't get together all that terribly much. So that, of course, leads to the issue of what can we do about this, right? I hope at least most of you are interested in trying to figure out, can we improve this situation somehow? And it seems to me that if we're going to do that, we have to do, you know, one thing we have to do is to try to make this enterprise more relevant to the legal profession, because it's a huge number of lawyers. The legal system is very important and very large, and it's going to take some work in order to do that. But a lot of the work that has been done up to now, often if it's done at least by non-lawyers, tends to be of marginal interest to the legal profession, because the people doing the work are not addressing the legal profession, they're not addressing the issues that matter to the legal profession, they don't even know what matters to the legal profession. They're just, oh, let's do another discourse analysis of a trial. Well, great, and linguists might find that interesting, but there might also be something interesting for lawyers in that, but linguists have often very little idea of what might possibly be interesting to the legal profession. And they often have very little idea of how to speak to the legal profession, because they have their own terminology and so forth and so on. Addressing that, I think, requires the best way, of course, is to have a degree in both fields, you know, but most of us don't have the time or energy to do that. I mean, there are some of us, like Larry and I, who like to go to school but most, you can't expect that of most people. And so it seems to me that in the alternative, you know, if you're a linguist, spend some time and learn something about law, right? That's one option, or vice versa. The other option, which I think often works very well, is to simply cooperate. So some of the best work, like Conley and Abar, have done some terrific work. One is an anthropologist, one is a lawyer. And those two teams together have done some very important work on language in trial settings. So that's a way to go about it. The other possibility is, well, maybe we should have an organization that sort of serves as at least a sort of overall organization. And that's the last thing here on the handout. I actually have reserved the domain name, ILLA.org. I have a whole bunch of domain names. But anyway, this is one of them. Oh, shut up. Anyway, this is one of them, and it stands for International Language and Law Association. And if we'd like to set up a website and an informal organization, send me an email or talk to me, and my time's up. All right.